See, is there, what does it mean that Al Tadamim Benavshe and Kiyam Hacharesh Tacharishi Revach Vatzala, that if you'll be silent, then salvation will come from a different quarter? It means he's reminding her of the fact the Jewish, I don't know if, he doesn't know exactly what's going to happen, and he, if that's the case, if Revach Vatzala Yamot, so then why is he going around in the sackcloth and ashes? What's he so concerned about? The Jews, I don't know if he means this particular, it means to say that the Jewish people is under the Ashkacha. The Jewish people is under the Ashkacha. Everything, so therefore you have to take that into consideration over here. However, it's a very delicate balance. We have to gauge our actions with, in recognition of this fact that the Jewish people is under the Ashkacha, but of course we don't know exactly how the Ashkacha is going to work. That does not free us in any way of our obligations. Our obligations are to do everything within, is to do everything within the framework of the natural order. That's you see in the situation of Yaakov Avinu. Even though he was close to God and he was prayed to God, but he had to do everything possible that the situation afforded. The same thing over here. That in the long run, the Jewish people it's all part of God's will, and the Jewish people will survive. But you will have lost your opportunity, because the situation demands that you act. So I'm calling upon you. Don't think I'm calling upon you, because the destiny of the Jewish people is in your hands. You have the control. The ultimate control over here is God. And that's something that we keep in the back of our minds. And even though we don't know exactly, we can't be reckless about that. We have to act rationally, but we have to bear that in mind. And if you see, if there's any possibility over here that your answer, the fact that you're not putting yourself in the line of fire, it's not just simply a rational machlokas over here, it's because you have certain emotions. You're not in that framework yet. You're not prepared. You haven't arrived at that state where you're prepared to risk everything, because you've gotten a little bit comfortable in the situation. Then he's sort of like reminding her. He's bringing it to her attention that it could be that the reason why you've taken such a position is because you're not in line. Your emotions are not in line with the full dimension of the reality. You do see that she was sort of like sending out clothing, whatever. In other words, acting in a more practical kind of a way. So that's what he's getting through to her. That this is your obligation. The entire situation points to you. It's your obligation, and you have the chiyuv to be moser nechesh. And then he says, "Umiyod, then don't think. I think it umiyodayim leis kozos he got la malchus." Because you might. What is that? What is that idea over there? And who knows if at this time means to say that you have a right to do this. I don't think he's saying that I know for sure that this is that this is all part of God's plan to put you in this place, and therefore it has to work. He's not saying that. If that's the case, if he knows all of this, then he would have communicated that, and then there'd be no challenge over here. Why should But it means that insofar as he can look at the situation, his knowledge of all the factors, including to whatever extent he can gauge the hashkacha, it makes sense. It makes sense that you should do what you're doing, and you shouldn't be concerned about the risk. And you see, her answer is chasher avadati avadati. Chasher. It's very similar to who in the Torah. It's very similar to Yaakov. When Yaakov finally agrees, you see that the Yaakov too had tremendous resistance to sending Binyamin. And the whole plan of the Ashkacha that was part of Yosef's plan was to create a situation in which he would be forced to separate himself from Binyamin, because of that, to overcome that attachment. But he didn't want to overcome that attachment until finally there was no choice. They would all perish. And the only way to get food was to send Binyamin down. And what, Anisha Kasher Shacholti Shacholti. Just like I've been bereft of my one son, I'm prepared. In other words, I fully accept the dictates that reality is placed upon me, and I'm freeing myself of any attachment to anything, to my most cherished personal emotion. So in the case of Yaakov, it had to do with Binyamin at that point in time. In the case of Esther, she has changed 180 degrees. She's in a totally different framework. Kasher avadati avadati. She recognizes that this is the demand that the Ashkacha has placed upon her. And that's the message that the Mordechai wanted to get through to her. That for the sake of Kol Yisrael, it makes sense to put your life at risk at this point, because that is the only thing that has a chance of succeeding. Okay, suggesting is the what?
She didn't really work it out herself. She didn't even work.
Yeah, the fact that in her answer, the fact that she proposed to operate differently was not a matter purely just a matter of a rational, you know, difference on how to operate in practical terms, but also did indicate a certain state that she didn't really relate to the danger in the same way that Mordechai had. Apparently Mordechai had tremendous respect for her intelligence, and that there's no reason why she wouldn't see the point in the exact same way. So, in other words, he was definitely rebuking her. That check your emotions, analyze yourself, and see whether your position over here is based purely on rational considerations, or whether there's some underlying emotions over here. Because that's anybody, even a great tzaddikim, have emotions. So that he was giving her the message that she should analyze herself. And she did. And then she says, when she hears that message, you see, Kenos, because she's a different person. She had to undergo a change. And then she launched her plan. What I'm saying is that Mordechai, the essence of Mordechai's position is that if you take, the way you're going right now, I can read your mind. And you're not responding to the problem, to the crisis, in the proper framework. You're not in a state of chasher avadati avadati. This can only be done in the framework of Mesiras Nefesh. And otherwise it's just going to fail. And you've got to be prepared to put your life on the line for Klal Yisrael. I don't think that it's simply because of a practical reason. He would have said that. That's not indicated at all in his words. And from the subsequent story, it seems pretty clear that they had plenty of time until Adar. They had 11 months. And there's no indication that anything was going to happen before that. Of course, speed is of the essence. Speed is clearly of the essence in this type of a situation, because once the time to nip this type of a thing is in the bud, you know, when there's a new policy and you're against it, the longer it's in effect, the longer it becomes entrenched, the more difficult it is to change it. That's true when you're dealing with the government on any level, any institution, when they want to institute a new tax or a new law, whatever it is. If you're opposed, you beg it out there as early as possible. Because it's different, and once it's part of the laws, even if it's a stupid law, it's hard to change laws. Nobody likes to change laws. It becomes much more difficult, and the institutional resistances become greater. So that's correct. You have to act immediately. But I don't accept that interpretation.
Then now is to try and understand the so-called strategy of Esther. What was her plan? Did she have a plan? Now bear in mind that Mordechai had given her instructions. The instructions weren't too extensive. Basically, to go before the king and to plead for mercy. Now, let's take a look at what she actually did. Of course, first, we said that she underwent a certain change. That was very important. The first thing, this is an important element in the story, to show the difference between the tzaddik and the rasha. The Russia acts immediately on his impulse. But when she agreed, she said, call a fast of 3 days. Which means that she recognized that the first thing you have to do is to... It can't be, in other words. It cannot be that we find ourselves in this type of a tzara and we're totally innocent. That's an impossibility. I'd say that's the basic premise of Yadis. That anytime a person finds himself in a calamitous situation, of course the natural tendency is to blame it all on external factors, for which you can always find many. But it's an impossible, even where that is true, even where you have been victimized, it cannot be that it doesn't relate to defects within yourself, to the extent that you've departed from the proper way. So therefore there are 3 days of tshuva, introspection. It's only when there's no point in launching any kind of a plan, as long as you're still involved in the basic distortion which got you into the situation in the first place. That's the first thing. So first you have to repair yourself and in terms of your relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now after the 3 days, she then goes ahead with her plan. Now let's take a look. Let's go through the psukim and let's see what are the issues over here, what's difficult. So it says that was on the third day, Vatilbash Esther Malchus. And Esther dressed up in royal garments. Okay. Now, any questions so far? Does that indicate? Yeah.
It indicates that until that point she had.
Yeah, but why? Right, and why? That itself is a choice. That's again something we could easily take for granted. But that itself is a choice. Was that the most appropriate way to dress, Malchus? You see, that's a far cry from the Sak Va'efer of Mordechai. Not to say that she should have dressed in Sak Va'efer. That would not have been appropriate. However, you would have thought that it's a somber occasion, it's something serious, you don't dress up in Malchus, Big Day Malchus. But she chose to dress up in Big Day Malchus. And then it says that she stood outside the inner courtyard, facing the king, facing the house of the king, and the king was sitting on his throne. And this is the first part, this is the most important part of the operation. So it says, when the king saw Esther standing in the courtyard, so she curried favor in his eyes. Nosachain bi'enav. That's extremely important. Vayoshet ha-melech li-Esther ha-shavet ha-zohav. And he extended the golden scepter that was in his hand, and she approached, and she touched the tip of the scepter. That was the protocol that you had to go through. Okay, so far so good. So far she's been successful. She's passed the first hurdle. Because Achas Daso Lohamas. At this point, she had just risked her life, according to what we've been told was the custom of the time. The question, your question is, how didn't she know Achashverosh intimately because she was his wife? That's a different type of a situation. That's I don't think that is the case. But if you're going to ask a question, the question would be, you led me to a question. Go ahead, a stronger question. It's a good question. I don't think I've ever asked this question before. The idea that she would be afraid that he would kill her seems very difficult to accept, given the situation that she had been selected and that he was thrilled and he made a party and she was a replacement for Vashti, and it was clear from every indication that he had a great deal of love. Of course, subsequently also, you see, of course, because you can't fault a person, for not knowing what was revealed later on. But you could say, given all the factors, that we are not surprised at his reaction. We're not surprised at his reaction. That fits the picture, the way we would understand it to be, that he would certainly stretch out the golden scepter, and that he offered at Chatiya Malchus. So given all these things, I'd say the question would be, why would she fear that he would kill her arbitrarily just because, let's say there was a rule, but why would it have to apply to her?
History.
That's the question. That's the question. And therefore, it would call into question the legitimacy of her a fear. Yeah. Chasher avarati is definitely the truth. That she entered into a situation of sakana, knowing that she could be killed immediately. The question is why? It doesn't seem to fit, the entire personality of Achashverosh and his tremendous affection that he had for her.
Okay, she
knows the personality of the Russia. Achashverosh is essentially a Russia. He's a Russia. He's not a perfected individual. And therefore, there's an element of unpredictability. He could love you 1 minute and he can kill you the next minute. And that's something she based her plan upon that. Take a look at the relationship with Haman. That one minute they're Vamelach Vahaman Yashvu Lishtos. You'd think that the tremendous bond between the two of them, they're working together. And now it doesn't take much longer and he's...
So therefore, what she was saying is that this is a rule. This is a rule in terms of the protocol of the state. Now, if she is to violate it, you could say that it's similar to what Vashti did. The same thing. Violating the you see what happens. When you question his authority, you're in trouble. So he'll get his advisors together. The idea was very real, that the fear was very real. It was based on reality. So she was taking a chance. And the fact, in spite of all the great love, it just goes to show you that that's a different type of a love. The love of an Ahasuerus is simply a love which stems from the Nefesh HaBahami, from the instinctual side of man. And that is not, no intelligent person would base themselves on that type of a thing. It's not something which you can trust. Of course, people make that mistake. I mean, it's applicable to every aspect of your own life, because we're involved in those types of emotions, and we get involved in those types of relationships. And then you assume that if you have such a feeling, or if that person has such a feeling for you, so then it's something you can, you know, you can't imagine that the person would ever betray you. But you have to realize that, but these betrayals take place every day. Right? The answer is because it's just an emotion. And it stems from the instinctual part of man, and that is not something that I would base myself on. Put any kind of serious trust in a person behaving towards me on the basis of that emotion, which is here today and gone tomorrow. Even al tiftachu ben adivim. I mean, you don't put too much trust in people in general, but certainly in this particular aspect. That's why it was a very real danger that she was going into, and she had no way of knowing in advance that what his reaction would be. Of course, she tried to set up the situation. That's why she dressed in a certain way and she made the appearance. She was hoping for a certain reaction, and she achieved the reaction that she wanted. Nasa chein b'einav. That's what she was hoping for. But the interesting Megillah does point out, Nasa chein b'einav. Now, just sort of another, why does it have to say Nasa chein b'einav? Why not say, of course, come in? Well, you don't need Nasa, this is his wife. What do you mean Nasa chein b'einav? I would say that those words are superfluous in the Megillah. The Megillah should have simply recorded that she came and it's fine. Of course, Esther comes and of course she's going to be given entree. She's different. The answer is Nasa chein v'einav. At that, it was a fortuitous moment. The Ashkacha, whatever, however you want to understand it. Because Nasa chein v'einav, which means it didn't have to be that way, because chein comes and chein goes. It was the right situation for Nasa Chein, then Vayoshet. So every word in the Megillah counts. The Chein V'Einav is part of the Nes, in the sense that it's the result of the Ashkacha. But you needed it. You needed it. The Nasa Chein V'Einav, in the context of the Psukim, is intended to explain to you Vayoshet HaMelech, that he stretched forth the golden scepter, which meant he said, you live. That's basically what it's intended to do in the context of the Megillah. What do you think should have happened at this point in time? What should she have done at this point in time? Now is the perfect opportunity. Don't delay. Why put off something as significant as this? This is the most important hurdle that's been overcome. You now have the king in a very good disposition, in a very good mood. Now is the time to come in and to make your plea. So, Vayomal Melech Malach Esther Amalka. What is it, Esther Hamalka? Uma bakasha seich. Interesting, he knew that she had a request, even though she hadn't said it. At chatzi hamalchus v'yinasein lach. Up to half of the kingdom. Now this means to say that a very strong emotion had been aroused to the extent that he really wanted to please her. So if he really wants to please, this is the time to do it. I mean, in general, you advise people, you know, when you need something, a favor, or you're waiting to meet with an important guy, and you finally don't put it off. And you know, sometimes you're lazy about it. I'll meet with him next week. You know, what I mean, next week he'll be in a different world. You got him right now. You got his attention. Make the request right now.
Well, I would imagine that they don't.
Achashverosh operates on the basis of emotion. She had evoked chain. The explanation for, you see, he's very grandiose. When he's in the right mood, he's ready to give up half the king. I'd chatzi. Not more than that. You see, even the generosity, the beneficence of the Russia, within limits. I still remain the king. You get half. That's what the Amalchus. That's what the Amalchus. Whether he would have kept that, we never know. We never get to find out.
Yeah,
okay.
Vatomer Esther, Emel HaMelech Tov. So what does Esther say? If it's good with the king, Yevo HaMelech V'Haman Hayom El HaMishteh Asher Asisi Lo. Then let the king and Haman come today to the party. So she postpones. She postpones the request, but instead she sets up a party. And this is very difficult. What is the purpose of this party? What's the purpose of the party? And why bring Haman to the party? You would have imagined, had I caught you before you read this the first time, you'd have said the worst thing in the world is to get Haman in the situation. What you really want to do is to reach him when he's apart, to reach Achashverosh when he's apart from Haman. Haman is the enemy. He's the danger. He's the man who's the author of this whole plan. So what do you want to bring him into the picture for? Okay, but what? Then we don't understand. She has a strategy. Vayomer HaMelech, and the king said, Maru es Haman, lasos es dvar Esther. Hurry. Quickly, bring Haman to do the bidding of Esther. Vayevo HaMelech v'Haman el HaMishteh she'osa Esther. So Haman and the king came to the party that Esther made. Now, what is the interesting term in this? What word is interesting in this part of the pasuk?
Party going good.
Vayomer HaMelech maharu. Hurry, hurry. What does that mean? What does that show you?
He really wants to please her.
Yeah. Right. Instant. See the.
Continuous gratification.
Instant gratification. The instinctual individual can't postpone. He has to have. In other words, she's aroused a very powerful emotion within him, and he can't wait. Maharu. Maharu tells you the way the guy functions. He doesn't stop and think. You would imagine that he would stop and think. This is a little bit of, a lot of unusual things have happened over here. First of all, she's made this sudden appearance, for which he really doesn't. He has no idea why, but he just responds to it on the basis of his emotions. Ad chatzi amalfas, and then she says to come to the party. Oh, maharu is Haman. Okay, but anyways, we still don't understand what the function of the party is. Let me just get all the questions out. Then, okay, vayomer HaMelech liEsther v'mishteh hayayin. And now they're at the party, and you would assume that this is the appropriate moment. Mash Eila Seich v'yinasen lach. What is your request, and it will be given to you. Uma bakasha seich, and what is your petition? Atchatia malchus v'seos. He's already promising that he'll give her whatever she wants. Okay. So what does she say? Vatan Esther v'tomar, and Esther answered and said, She'elasi uvakashasi. This is my request, and this is my petition. Imotzasi chein b'enei hamelech, if I found favor in the eyes of the king. V'yimel hamelech tov, and if it is good with the king. Loseis esh elosi v'lasos es bakashasi, to do my request and my bidding. Yavo hamelech v'haman el hamishteh she'es elahem. Let the king and Haman come to the party that I will make for them. U'mochar esek et var hamelech. And tomorrow I will do as the king commands. So this is a difficult time. Why? What is the purpose of this request? Also, you see how she
invites him to a party. Only
she buttresses this request, but this time she says Imot Sasi Chain, V'Yimel Malach Tov, Lasei Seshe Lasei, the Lasas. What is the purpose of that? Again, that would seem to be not the correct way to go. The correct way to go would seem to be to, now
he got his attention.
He's already said, I'll give you whatever you want, so now put it on the table.
Yeah.
But no, what do you gain by postponing it till the next day? You're taking a tremendous risk. The risk is that who knows what could happen between you, especially with a guy like Achashverosh. Any kind of a crisis can come up. So what's the purpose? What is the purpose of this? Okay, let's just pause there. The salvation of the Jews comes about through two different causes. And one of them seems to be the intervention, hishtadlus, as they say. Hishtadlus. It's a very important idea in Yahadus. Because in Yahadus, what is the proper way to deal with a crisis that comes upon us? Are we to withdraw from the situation and rely on our relationship with God and prayer, reliance on a Kadosh Baruch Hu,
Or are we supposed to engage in dealing with the fact, you know, dealing with the situation in accordance with our own abilities? Ishtadl said to intervene, to try and change the situation. So in the Megillah we see two things at work, it would seem. On the one hand, you see the plan of Esther, and the plan, as we know, is successful. The next, you know, tomorrow night the party comes, you all know the end. She makes a request, and it works. It's successful. But the Megillah goes on to tell us the story of Balayla Ahu. And clearly we know that the Megillah is Pirsumei Nisa. That the whole purpose of reading the Megillah is to publicize the miracle. So where's the miracle? I mean, were the Jews... Let me put the question this way. Were the Jews saved because of the brilliance of her plan? That's one type of thing. Or were they saved because of the intervention of God, which is an ace? If that's the case, so what's so important about her plan? What's going on over here? What is the essence of the whole situation? You understand what I'm saying? Clearly a person would say that they were saved, there was an ace. I mean, that's clear. Presume Nisa, Al Hanisim. All right, if it's Al Hanisim, so what is the importance of this party that she's making? How does that fit into the picture? What's the connection between the two? Okay? Now, the next segment tells us about how this is important. The question I'm posing to you, though, is, well, we know what happens. So let's read it, and then we'll set up the question. Haman leaves on that day, Sameach v'tov lev. This is for him the greatest, clearly the greatest moment of his life, in a state of pure joy, right? Because he's gotten the thing he wants the most, the epitome of honor. V'cheros Haman es Mordechai b'shar ha'melech. But when he saw Mordechai in the gate of the king, v'lo kam v'lo zamimenu, and he didn't get up, nor did he move. Didn't even move. By Imole Haman al Mordechai chema, and Haman was filled with rage against Mordechai. So, what's interesting about that? The thing is, v'chiros Haman when he saw him. When he saw him, he knew what happened. What did he see that he hadn't seen before? Right? He knew that he saw before. It says that Mordechai lo yechum lo yishtachva, and that's when he formulated the decree to wipe out the Jews. Right? But you, what? So this was Zara. So this was worse. He didn't even move. But you see that he lives in the world of the sensual reality. As long as he did, he knew the reality that Mordechai is out there, and that he didn't expect that Mordechai would suddenly get up and bow down to him. You see? But his emotional life is tied up with the immediate physical situation. He doesn't live in the world. In other words, if this phenomenon bothers him so much, so he should have been unhappy the whole time. No, but as long as he doesn't see it, it doesn't exist for him. Existence for him is only that which he can perceive. All right. So now this also shows you the whole basis of his happiness has no foundation whatsoever, because the moment of greatest joy can't last. It's subject to any whim. Yeah. Why did Haman? Simply go to his going to the party was basically a trap. He was walking voluntarily into a trap. This was a trap for him. He didn't know it at the time. Esther had no doubt of the way he'd reacted. He definitely would go. Because here he's in basically the same thing. He's an instinctual being, except his instinct, the primary mover for Haman is the ego. So she knew that this, what kind of an effect this invitation would have. That he's invited to a special party, that it's just the king and the queen. He wouldn't stop and worry. His guard would be down. He would interpret, just in the same way, when Ahasuerus asks him, what should be done to the person whom the king wants to honor? He answers instinctively, and he reveals his true emotions. So, there's no, you know, that fits in very well with the whole personality of Haman, that he definitely would seize. This is what he lives for. That's why Sameach v'tov lev. She understood this. She used tremendous psychological understanding. She understood that Haman, this is what he's living for. When it comes to an area like this,
That's why people fall. When do they fall? Make mistakes. You see businessmen, successful people. When you finally, everybody's searching for a certain fantasy, and when you're involved in, when you're caught up in that, along the way, they're making moves, they're very shrewd, they're very intelligent, they check out. Once they're involved in the ultimate fantasy, then they're not careful anymore. Although, from a purely practical, what was he to do? What was Haman to do? He could have been more careful, but this seems, anyway, it'd be difficult to make a case that he really should not have gone to this party. What was his alternative? She really set it up in a way, first of all, she knew he would definitely go. But more than that, he would go with his guard down. She was not at all concerned that he would be up there. He was up that night for a different... Both Achashverosh and Haman couldn't sleep that night. Each one for two different reasons. Achashverosh couldn't sleep for inner psychological reasons. But Haman probably would have had a good night's sleep were it not for the fact that he saw Mordechai. I don't know that that was part of her plan. I think there's a combination of good planning and hashkacha is working together hand in hand. That's what the Megillah is all about. The reason why it highlights Ohavav v'Zeresh Ishto clearly, it's two different influences. There's Ohavav. But also it shows you a Russia. Who does a Russia? See a chacham. Who would a chacham get together with? A chacham would not get together with his friends. He would get together with neutral, intelligent advisors. You would seek out, if you have a really serious problem, you try and seek out objective people. You know, your tendency is when you're down to surround yourself with friends because more or less, they're going to tell you what you want to hear. But Ishto is a different emotion. She had a hold upon him. So it doesn't mean to say that, I don't think it means to say that there's Ohav of those, and the wife is on a different level. It means that it was a different emotion. He was under the sway of the emotion of his wife. That's why she gets the main credit for the plan, right? Isn't it basically her plan? Beresh is a strange character, because later on, after he comes back, she really gives him a patch in the next
meeting.
In the next meeting, she says, "If you've that's a very hard thing also to understand. Like, what's going on over here? What's he telling him? That if he's Jewish and you've begun to fall before him, you're going to get wiped out. But Zeresh, his wife, is mentioned because she has a separate influence. She has a strong influence upon him. Okay, so the question is why she decided to postpone asking her request and what's the purpose of the party? And also, why does she invite Haman to the party? Now, what is the king's reaction? The king's reaction is interesting. Maharu at Haman. You see that the pasuk emphasizes, hurry, hurry and get. He doesn't just command to get Haman, but he commands to fetch him in a hurry, which means that he's in a state of strong curiosity. He has to have gratification. He can't wait. Okay, so they bring Haman, and the king and Haman come to the party. Now, what happens at the party? Again, he asks, "What's your request, and it'll be given to you? And what's your petition up to half the kingdom?" And again, Esther is very. You would think that now is the time, because this is what she wanted. She wanted them to be together at the party and to make her pitch, but instead she postpones it. She postpones it until the next night. Let the king and Haman come to the party that I'll make for them. And tomorrow she'll reveal. Tomorrow she'll do as the king requests. Okay. Then Haman leaves, full of joy. But when he sees, then he sees Mordechai. And Mordechai didn't stand nor move because of him. He was filled with rage. So he controls himself and he goes to his house. And he calls for his friends and his wife Zeresh. And then he, what's the connection between this? Take a look, what's the connection between 11? And Haman tells them the glory of his wealth and his many sons and all the promotion, the king had promoted him and elevated him over all the officials and servants of the king. What does that have to do with anything? What is that a response to? Where is that coming from? Haman is defending himself against unstated charges. No one has said anything. And Mordechai hasn't said anything to him at all. But he's defending himself. Most people have to defend themselves to some authority they've established in their mind. And in this case, it would appear that he was totally devastated by Mordechai's failure to acknowledge him. And this destroyed his whole self-image. So he has to reconstruct. Now, how does he deal with reconstructing his self-image? Through convincing others. That's the mechanism of the Russia. If he can convince enough people, he lives in the world of the reality of human opinion. So he gathers together. Even there, it's not objective because it's not a fair sampling. It's a loaded deck. I mean, it's his wife and it's his friends. So, and of course, what they're not going to tell him the truth. But nevertheless, for him, you know, that's the way he operates. Then he tells them about the party, and that the king invited no one except him, and that tomorrow he's invited with the king. But then he says, Kol Zayin Inu Shoveli. Then he expresses clearly that all this doesn't mean a thing to him. You see? It's interesting. He doesn't learn the proper lesson. All this is meaningless to me. Every time I see Mordechai HaYehudi. Every time he sees Mordechai HaYehudi. What should he have learned from this? So they, of course, say, well, of course, the problem is Mordechai. He says, everything that I've gotten, all this honor and glory is not worth a thing to me. Every time I see Mordechai HaYehudi standing in the, sitting in the courtyard of the king. He doesn't even mention that, and he doesn't get up for me. Just as every time I see him. So what should he have deduced from this?
What should
he have learned? What would a wise person have said? There must be something wrong with me. There must be something wrong with my entire system. If I've achieved everything, I mean, it's illogical. If I've achieved everything I want, if this is the true good, so what difference does it make? What difference does one individual make? You should look within yourself. The problem lies within you. That's the correct way to go. But no. They come to the conclusion that they can control the reality. So let's get rid of them. So make a tree. Make a tree and get... Oh, and in the morning tell the king and hang Mordechai. Okay? So they gave him the advice that he wanted to hear. It turned out that it was not good advice. It also turned out that he didn't really listen to them because they said that he should wait until morning. But he didn't wait till morning because it's that night. See, this is the connection between what happens to Haman after the party and the relationship with the miracle of that night. Now, that night, the king couldn't sleep. Okay? So, he commanded them to bring the records, the official records. And they were reading before him. Then he sort of focused in on the story of Bigson and Seresh, who had sought to destroy him, the assassins. And suddenly, Pasuk Gimel is difficult. Suddenly the king said, what honor and glory was done for Mordechai because of this? And the servants of the king said, nothing was done. Alright? Yeah, of course all this is difficult. First of all, why couldn't he sleep? Was this just an accident? And why was he reading the books? Was that the normal thing for him to do? And why did he, was it an accident that he focused, on this particular story, which he was aware of before? And why was it so important to him that Mordechai had not been rewarded? Okay, but suddenly these thoughts are interrupted by the presence of, now, it's interesting drama, all of a sudden Mordechai makes his appearance. Excuse me. Still on the Ad Lo Yoda. All of a sudden, Haman makes his appearance. And the king says, who was in the courtyard? And Haman had come to tell the king to hang Mordechai on the tree that he had prepared for him. Okay. So then they tell the king that Haman is in the courtyard, and the king says for him to come. Then it says that Haman came, and the king says to him, now this part is interesting, because he asks him, let's focus in on these psukim. What shall be done to the man whom the king wants to honor? And then Haman says in his heart, whom does the king want to honor more than me? We're given an insight into Haman's interpretation. Haman thinks it's all about him. And Haman says to the king, the man that the king wants to take a look at the next few sentences, you know, what's the key theme that the king wants to honor? Let them bring the royal dress that the king wears and the horse that the king rides on and place the crown on his head. And then they dress him up in the garments and the horse and one of the assistants of the king and lead him through the city and call out before him, thus shall be done to the man whom the king wants to honor. Now, what's interesting about this, of course, that the king says to Haman, hurry, take the garments and the horse, and as you said, of course he omits the crown, interestingly enough. There's an omission over there. The crown, he omits the crown. So he doesn't follow him exactly. And do this to Mordechai the Jew, who's sitting in the courtyard of the king. Do not leave out anything from everything which you have suggested. Now, you see that the Russia lives in the world of the immediate. He cannot tolerate any type of a pain. All he had to do was wait a few more months and he would have been executed. Now by making a personal issue out of Mordechai, that's bad for the plan. That shows that there's something personal going on over here. And he had tried to persuade the king that it was purely an objective thing, that it wasn't personal. Like this. First of all, I have two questions. At this point in time, why did Ahasuerus frame the question that way? Why did he ask Haman, what shall be done with the man who the king wants to? Why not just confront him and say, what's the story over here? Why didn't you reward Mordechai? He doesn't rebuke him for failing to reward Mordechai, it's not that clear why that's so significant all of a sudden. Up until now, this apparently wasn't that significant. But even so, now if it is bothering the king, so why doesn't he confront him with that and say, what happened over here? I see that, I was just reading and I see that Mordechai was not rewarded. So why wasn't he rewarded? He doesn't do that. And then he says, well, what should we do to reward him? He doesn't do that either. He simply sets up the question in an entirely different way. What shall be done? He asks him, not telling him where he's going. Why did he do it that way? And secondly, once he had elicited the answer from him, why was it necessary that it be done through Haman? Why did he humiliate? It was a severe humiliation for had to have him do it, to have him lead him through the city. He could have had somebody else do it. I mean, clearly this wasn't essential to his purpose. He wasn't at this point, he was out to give Mordechai such glory that it had to be through Haman, who was the most elevated man in the kingdom. And it's clearly this is a severe humiliation of Haman. The question is why? What brought this about? Why did he do all of this? But it seems clearly that for Haman this is a terrible humiliation. Because what happens afterwards? He goes back and he gets his friends to try and put the pieces back together again. He's totally destroyed. And they, Zeresh, this defines this as being the beginning of the end. She says, if this man is a Jew and so forth, all of a sudden it's a totally different picture. Asher hachilos alinfo lefanav, that you've begun to fall before him, lo tuchalo. You won't be able to stand up because you'll fall. Kinaf al tipolo.
So it seems clearly that this is a humiliation. This is the beginning of the end of Haman. So it wasn't just by accident that that was the case. It would seem to be a deliberate kind of a thing. At this point in time, I'd like to see if we can get some type of a glimpse into the strategy, the plan of Esther. What did she clearly had an idea in mind. She approached this with thought. That's significant. You see that because she didn't. It doesn't seem that she followed exactly the advice of Mordechai said to just go and plead. But she didn't do that. She clearly had a plan because she didn't ask the king at first when she got permission to enter. And she requests the party. And she, all these different things. And she invites Haman. That clearly had to be part of a plan. And then most significant of all is that she refuses to say what she wants at the first party and asks for and receives, you know, the request for a second party. Is it possible for us to sort of get some type of an idea of what was her strategy? What was she thinking? What was she hoping for? Before Esther embarked on her plan, let's assume that she analyzed the nature of the problem she was facing. Now she was going to ask, her objective was to ask Ahasuerus to rescind the decree, which was not an easy thing to do. And especially in light of the fact that it was a decree to which he had given his own endorsement. He was, you know, it's one thing to ask to rescind something that Haman had, it wasn't that simple. Haman had come to Ahasuerus with a plan, right? There is one nation who's different and dispersed and so forth, and they're not loyal. Yeah, but Ahasuerus had agreed. And not only that, but Ahasuerus had even given the money, if you remember. So she had a formidable task in front of her. Alright? Now, what was her objective over here? How did she figure that she'd be able to be successful? She had, I think, in other words, there's one essential element in her plan. All this is leading. They're very jealous about that, and certainly honor. But he was willing to give tremendous power and tremendous honor. So this shows you something. Now the story of the party and his request about Vashti shows you the type of person that he was. There are two kinds of character in the Megillah. There's the personification of the Rasha, and there's the personification of the Tzaddik. The Rasha is basically the person who lives in accordance with his instincts. Yeah, but there's two different types. Ahasuerus represents one manifestation. He's the one who likes to indulge the pleasures, the physical pleasures, the sexual pleasures, the party guy. So he was involved in, that's why he threw this tremendous party and drinking and the golden vessels and the women and calling Vashti. So that's, he was not interested, it would seem. His major objective was not power for the sake of power, but he wanted to enjoy all the pleasures. Now a person like that, you can't be involved in both worlds. You can't be involved. It's interesting, most of the high-powered business tycoons, the guys that put in 18 hours a day, they may be making billions and billions of dollars, but they're not the ones that are spending it or enjoying it. Somebody else's. Maybe it's their wife, maybe it's their children. So they can't be luxuriating in the pleasures of this world and being involved in building empires at the same time. It's an impossibility. It's two different functions. So Ahasuerus, at this point anyways, was attracted to the pleasures. Therefore, he needed a manager. Now, Haman, the Chazal said that he was Mamuchan. He was the person that had said, he was the one who gave the advice to kill Vashti because of her rebelliousness. Because you say that he was involved in ego. For him, the entire essence was ego empowering. He was not interested in indulging himself in the pleasures per se. Or money, his wealth, all those things were only a means for bolstering his ego. For him, this is Haman. So an alliance is created between the man of passion, the man of desire, and the man of power. The two operate together. That's why he's willing to give him all of this honor and all this power, because he wants him to manage everything for him. This removes the entire burden from him. That's the basis of the relationship. Now, a relationship like that, will this be the last point for today, and then tomorrow we'll try and go. The relationship, that's, let's assume, we're just speculating now, that Esther analyzed. She, obviously, she was, extremely, extremely brilliant. She analyzed the relationship. Now, in order for her plan to succeed, she had to somehow break, she had to attack the weak link in that relationship. What would the weak link in that relationship be? As far as this thing can exist, Ahasuerus can only be happy as long as he's totally convinced. Here's a man with a tremendous ego, with a tremendous drive and ambition. Now, as long as the man is totally loyal to me, that's a wonderful thing. Yeah, but can you depend upon that? People that have that type of a framework, type of an of desires, are they loyal to somebody else? Now, it would seem that in their first joint venture, when Haman presents the plan about the Jews, and then Ahasuerus accepts it, you see, he accepts it. He doesn't even investigate. He accepts it. It indicates that he had total confidence. Then it says, and the king and Melech Haman, then they sat down to drink. They were satisfied. But all of this, see, Esther realized, in my opinion, that all of this depended upon the fact that Ahasuerus had total confidence in Haman. Yeah, but there must be a part of him which he is repressing, which is insecure, which has doubts. There's got to, in a relationship of that nature, there are always doubts. And I think you could, you can relate to this from your own experience in the world at large, and if you have a partner, if you have a business, or you, anyone, whenever you have somebody, and you're very excited because this person is talented and working for you and all that, extremely ambitious, you like that because their ambition is beneficial to you. But there's always got to be a certain amount of doubt because, a selfish person, he can be useful to you up to a point, but he's got his own agenda. At a certain point, is he really loyal to me? Now, in order for Ahasuerus to relax and enjoy it, he's got to take his mind. He's got to repress. There's got to be elements of doubt. And before Esther could find the right type of a situation for her plea to be accepted, because basically what she's will analyze what her version. See, when she finally makes her plea, she's giving her version of the plan. Haman already had given his version of the plan. Yeshno, that's called, there was the Yeshno Amecha, there's this nation that's dispersed and so forth. He'd given his version of the plan. Her objective was to give a totally different version of the plan, but she knew that in order to do so, she had to set the ground. And the strategy that she used is contained in the story of the parties. All right. Esther knew that Ahasuerus had invested a tremendous amount of energy and confidence in Haman, that Haman was loyal to him. And as long as he maintained that attitude that Haman was his trustworthy servant who had no objective other than to serve him, it would be extremely difficult to make her plea. So the basic aim of her strategy was to, well, she couldn't attack this directly either. She couldn't attack this idea directly. That's another thing. You see, her strategy was essentially the main elements that it contained were more of an indirect approach. She could not approach directly. She didn't just sit down and let's discuss this. She realized that that wasn't the way to go. Basically, what she needed was time. First of all, she needed time. That's why she didn't go immediately, even though she received permission. She didn't make her plea immediately. And that's why also she didn't even express herself at the first party. She realized that this type of a thing, first of all, needed time. And also the idea of overnight. So time was one element. And the other element was to get his mind working in a certain direction. To bring to... She understood, and we were all, again, this is speculation, that in such a relationship, there's always elements of distrust. There's always a question, is this person truly loyal to me? And there's always a person who always has doubts about that, and he always suppresses these doubts. And she was trying to think about a situation where these doubts would be aroused. So that's the idea. The dramatic appearance in front of Achashverosh is a dramatic thing. It's something which is going to have an emotional impact upon him. It was intended to arouse very powerful feelings. Desire. She was dressed in, that's why she dressed up in Malchus. Also the element of surprise, suspense, and curiosity. You see, he says, hurry, hurry and get home. He has to know. He's the type of person, he has to know what's going on over here. And she just puts this, she mentions this alongside everything else, and the party she's going to make together with Haman. At that point in time, he doesn't stop and ask why Haman. Why doesn't he stop and ask why Haman? What does Haman have to do with this? He doesn't stop and ask, but it registers. Apparently it registers. Because she leaves him that night in a state of frustration. He came to the party, he's all excited, he wants to find out what the situation is, and she chooses to, very deliberately, she chooses to leave him in a state of frustration. Because he walks out of there not satisfied. And then when a person is not satisfied, you see, so it bothers him, and then he goes and he tries to go to sleep. Now, at that point in time, see, there's a certain point in time, during the day, a lot of things are happening, and it's interesting. I mean, psychologically, you're not aware of the full significance of something at the time that it happens. Something very slight can happen in an encounter in the office, in the street, and you just brush it aside, and you go on to your business. And then later on, it can arouse a whole, you know, at night, all of a sudden you have a certain emotion, and you don't even know why, and you can trace it back. And something which appeared at the time to be very insignificant can be hitting something very deep within you. So that night, he was disturbed. Hashverosh was bothered, in my opinion. That's the point of having Haman there, because we said that strategically that didn't make any sense. Why bring the enemy? You don't want, if you're going to make it, you want to isolate Hashverosh. But the point is, this also arouses another train of thought. And that is, it's an unanswered question. What is Haman doing at this type of a thing? This is outside of his area. This is beyond the boundary line. This has nothing to do with matters of state, political affairs. This is something, a personal party that she's making for him. So now Haman is...
For Haman?
No, that she's making for Achashverosh. The party is for Achashverosh. This is... He's now entered into the area of their personal affairs. Who knows what this could possibly mean? So he's already... Suspicion has been aroused. That's the point. Suspicion has been aroused concerning Haman himself.
From the king.
Yeah, that's why, in my opinion, that's why, this will explain the events of that night. That's why he can't sleep. He can't sleep because he's troubled. He's troubled in general, but he's also concerned. He always has to be looking behind his shoulder. Of course, Haman is supposed to protect him from that, but now he may be having to look at Haman himself. Now, unconsciously, his mind is searching. Why, that's why he brings out the record books. He has not been looking at the record books because he's put all of his trust in Haman. There's no need to check the books. Now, he's concerned. Maybe this guy is... I'm not saying this is a conscious thought, but maybe this guy is scheming behind my back. So that would explain why he can't sleep, and that would explain the idea that it's connected to Haman would explain why he's checking the record books. He wants to see. He wants to examine more carefully what's been going on. Now, what does he happen to notice, and what grabs his attention? What grabs his attention is the incident with Bigson and Seresh. And the question is, why is that suddenly so significant? And what's bothersome about that is, he asks, was Mordechai rewarded? He's discovered something. So from all of his investigation, this is the one thing that he discovered, and this is the one thing that's troubling. Why? Why is that such an important thing? It's to arouse powerful emotions, to leave him in a state of frustration, and to suggest, indirectly suggest, that there is something significantly happening which has to do with Haman. Therefore,
therefore causing a certain amount of insecurity in the mind of the king with regard to the exact relationship with Haman. What is this character Haman? Now, because of all of these things, he can't sleep. And because of all these things, he begins to look at the records, which means that it's like a boss who had complete confidence in the office manager. He never looks at the records. There's no need to. But suddenly things have happened that cause him to be suspicious, and now he's looking at the records. Let me check the records. And then we said he focuses on the event of Bigson and Seresh, and that becomes very important to him. And the question we were at right now is, why is that so important to him? He points out very nicely that Bigson and Seresh also were people whom he trusted, were ministers who turned against him. So that's very good. That does show you that that a king can never have absolute security. I would say that's precisely what a person is searching for. He's searching for a state of absolute security. In my opinion, he considers that to be a serious political mistake, not to reward Mordechai. Let's understand why that's so. That's crucial why. You see that by his reaction. He has a very strong reaction. At that particular moment, Haman comes, and he doesn't even ask him what he came for. It's interesting. We know what Haman came for. He wanted permission to hang Mordechai. He doesn't even ask him that. He just asks him what should be done to the one whom the king wants to honor. Clearly, Mordechai must be honored. But then you see he takes it out on Haman. He humiliates Haman. Why? Did he just fabricate something out of thin air, or was there a reality over here? Was it a serious blunder? The reason why this is important to Ahasuerus is not because there's a beautiful deed out there that has to be rewarded, but from a purely practical consideration, it was necessary to reward. He understood that this is a big blunder because he's in a vulnerable position. The king is the ruler of a mighty empire, and there's always conspiracies. There are always people out there that are want to get him. Now, in such a situation, you need as many people as you can. I mean, they say that if a person is willing to give up his life, there's no protection at all for a president. They always say that. But it's there's truth in that. In that situation, if there are enough people out there that want to assassinate you, you're in constant danger. But the only thing you have working for you is if people come forth and provide you with the information. Now, Mordechai had done a tremendous service to the king, because he was in the courtyard and he heard the information, and he didn't have to do it, but he passed on the information, and this saved his life. So he saved the life of the king. This is a tremendously significant thing. Now, you leave that unpublicized. You don't reward him. It's exactly what we want to encourage people throughout the realm to be loyal and to report this type of information, and we want to discourage other people. Here's a perfect example. So, the immediate benefit of Mordechai's act is that he saves the life of Ahasuerus, but then it's significant, very important politically to honor him. That's why he wanted him to be honored. You could read into it and say that he really didn't care about honoring him, he just wanted to put down Haman. No, I don't believe that. It was extremely important to give honor, to reward Mordechai, in order to encourage other people. To encourage other people that this is the state policy, that the person took a risk. He did take a risk, because they could have found out about it. It's in chapter 2, the story of the conspiracy. It's just something which is dropped in ever so subtly in the basic narrative. It's in 2:21. In those days, it wasn't those days, and Mordechai was sat in the court of the king. So Bigson and Seresh got angry, two assistants of the king, and they sought to assassinate Ahasuerus. Then it says the matter became known to Mordechai, and he told it to the queen Esther, and Esther said it to the king in the name of Mordechai. That's Chazal make a big thing out of this, the fact that she said it over in the name of Mordechai. And they draw a big universal lesson from this, right? The famous statement, Omer Dov B'Shem Omro, that one who says something in the name of the author of the statement brings redemption to the world. That's considered to be very important in the Torah, that when you say, you shouldn't take credit for somebody else's ideas. So when you're saying over an idea, and you attribution, well, two things. First of all, that you don't plagiarize. There's two ideas in that. You don't plagiarize. And B, that you give proper attribution. If you say something in the name of the one who said it, you bring redemption to the world. And they learn it from here. Of course, the question is, well, what does that mean? What do you mean bring, in what sense are you bringing redemption to the world? And also, how do you learn it from here? This seems to be a different... This did bring redemption, but not for the, doesn't seem to be the same idea. It seems to be a separate thing. It just so happened that in this particular instance, the idea that Mordechai was loyal became very important. And Esther, apparently Esther had the option. When she gave over the information, she didn't have to. Mordechai apparently didn't instruct her to say it over in his name. She did that voluntarily, because Chazal drew from her behavior this idea. Because, so it turned out, in fact, that because she did it that way, it was very beneficial later on. And from this they go to a universal, which seems to have nothing to do with, you know, then they go, because the case we're talking about, where a person gets up and he says over an idea and he doesn't take credit for it and he gives credit to the one who authored it, what does that have to do with, doesn't seem to have anything in common with this. Nevertheless, the question that I raised was, why did he choose to convey the information through Esther? Why didn't he convey it directly? Why couldn't he convey it directly? We have to assume that a person like Mordechai, everything in the Megillah, there's a reason for it. It's not just later on, when he hears about the decree, so he chooses to put on sackcloth and ashes and go wailing through the streets. He doesn't go directly to Esther. And then Esther gets wind of it. At this particular point, his objective is, his decision was that he has to inform about this information. He doesn't want the king to be assassinated. But he would have thought that he'd have gone directly. Why didn't he go directly? In fact, Samosh is making the question stronger. Because at this point in time, Mordechai did not want the relationship revealed. Did not want anybody to know that Esther was Jewish. That was the policy. So why, again, this makes the question stronger. So why did he convey the information to her?
Bobby suggests that the king would believe it more if it came from Esther, but the Pusik makes it clear that they investigated the matter. Vayevukash, they investigated. In a case like that, that's clearly what is going to take place. He's not just going to accept the word and then execute. He's going to investigate. So no matter who brought forth the information, I would assume they would have investigated it. So now you're saying that he wants to enhance the stature of Esther. But that point has to be related to the underlying question of why he insisted that she not reveal her identity. What's the reason behind that? Told her not to reveal that she was Jewish or her lineage. Now Rashi points out because she stemmed from kingship, from royal blood, so to speak. And his desire was to extricate her. He was hoping that the marriage would not last. He didn't want to do anything which would strengthen it. Therefore, in other words, Achashverosh, of course, wanted someone who was very significant, very important. So if he knew that she was from royal blood, this would only increase his desire for it.
Royal blood?
What? Yeah, it's royalty, yeah. Well, you see, even though it was Jewish, the entire world has respect. That's precisely the one they want the most. Is the you see that he the rabbis say the vessels. He wanted the vessels from the temple. On the conscious level, they won't admit it, but the whole essence of anti-Semitism is rooted in an unconscious envy. It's really envy. They really recognize a certain element in the Jew, superiority, if you want to call it. And we're not making the claim that the Jews are superior. We never make that claim. The Torah tells us it's not the case, that we're not a superior race, and that we should not regard ourselves as such. That's not why God chose us. But that's what
I just mentioned that Freud said that ever since the Jews proclaimed that they were the chosen people a few thousand years ago, he said the rest of the world has acted as though deep down they truly believed it. The point is, if the world regarded that claim as absurd and ridiculous, then you wouldn't have the phenomenon of anti-Semitism. It's not, you don't hate a person or seek to undermine someone if he acts as though he's superior when it's not a threat to you, it's not a challenge, you think it's ridiculous. You see, but you do when you're trying to deny. Persecution is an attempt to deny something which you're afraid, in a certain realm of the mind, you're afraid might be true. I agree with Moshe that it's a purely practical type of a thing. And that is, I mean, you do learn something from this. And that you've got to be extremely careful in this type of a situation. You're dealing with cutthroats. You're dealing with people. The element of trust is vital in these types of things. So what was his alternative? He couldn't go directly before the king. That's not the way. Esther would not have been in the palace. Then you have to decide, you have to choose certain people whom you trust. And two things. First of all, in this type of a situation, and we see it today, every day, in every government in our country, every person who's involved in government has a personal interest, and there's a tremendous amount of danger. People can be extremely loyal one day. In fact, Chazal mentioned about Charbonah. At the end, when the king comes back and Haman falls on the bed of Esther, and Ahasuerus accuses that you're going to conquer the queen with me in the house, and then Charbonah steps in and says, oh, there's also the tree. Then he gives him the information about the tree. Now, how did he know about the rabbi? How did he know about the tree? And if he did know about the tree, so why didn't he tell him beforehand? All right. So apparently, maybe he was Chazal. So he might have been in on that conspiracy. He might have been one of Haman's men, or maybe he didn't. The point of it is, you see, he was an opportunist. He had the knowledge about the tree, but he didn't use it because he didn't know who'd emerge victorious. He had to see how the winds were going. Once he saw that the king stormed out, and then even then he didn't give him the, when he came back and he made that accusation against Haman, then he said and the tree. So he used the information when he saw that it was perfectly beneficial to him. Up until that point he didn't. I would say that two factors. You can't trust anybody in this situation. It's extremely dangerous. Because a person can appear to be loyalist to the king, and he could be a loyalist to the king, but the very next day he could be a loyalist to Bigson and Zeresh. Most of these types of people you're dealing with people who are not idealists. And if they're not idealists, you've got to be extremely careful. There are very few idealists out there. And you'd be amazed at how people can, if there's a change in power, a change in policy, you'd be amazed at how people who are diehard conservatives can come out completely the next day in favor of government spending when it's in their interest, and vice versa. We're always surprised at these types of things because we have this naive idea that there is such a thing as idealism out there. The second thing is that once the information goes out, it's very hard to control, which we see again in our society today. So apparently, he decided to choose the method which was safest. There was only one safe method. He knew and he trusted Esther. Esther he could trust. So the thing, what made the most sense was to convey the information to Esther. Then he knew that he would be safe. Apparently that's the only person with access who he would trust. Everybody else was suspect, in my opinion. That doesn't mean to say that if you asked his opinion, he might have said, I believe so-and-so is loyal, so-and-so is not. Yeah, but that's all opinion. He recognized that that's all opinion. And he recognized that his opinions could be completely wrong. He had no way of knowing who could be completely trusted. So there, but he did, except for one person he knew. One person who could be completely trusted, and that was Esther. So that's why he did it this way. Then Esther had the information, and she had the option to either give the information as our own discovery or to attribute it to Mordechai, and she attributed it to Mordechai because she reflected the true ideal, and that is to say that a person should always be in line with truth and should not seek to take credit for somebody else's ideas. And Chazal take it to a different plane. We'll discuss that at a different time. Why that's such a significant virtue, and why it's a virtue which is related to bringing redemption to the world. In Pasuk Yud, in chapter Beis, Pasuk Yud, it says, Lo Yida Esther es Amor. Esther did not reveal her nation or her birth, her background. Ki Mordechai tzivo ala asher lo sagit. For Mordechai had commanded her not to tell. Okay? Now, of course, the question is, why not? So take a look at Rashi. Asher lo sagit. Kidei she yomru shehim mishpacha bezuya. So she did not tell her true lineage and background so that they would say that she comes from a lowly family. And they would send her away. For if they knew the history, that if that King Saul, if they knew that she was from the family of Saul, Hamelech, the King Saul, they would want her. She'd be a prize catch. These things are extremely important in this type of a thing. She'd be, in addition to all of her natural beauty and charm, it turns out that she's from a royal house. That's royalty. The world today, that's a very big thing. It's royalty. People, especially a person like Achashverosh. So he wanted to do everything to play her down, to make her appear to be a commoner. A commoner, nothing, nobody. Clearly tells you that she was taken against her will. She didn't volunteer for this thing. She never would have gone. The implication is that she absolutely had no freedom, no way of avoiding this kind of thing. It wasn't something which they desired. And you see, that's why Mordechai instructed her not to give away this piece of information. It does show you that he considered this information to be of significance. And it does show you that you always have to realize, you know, because you probably was saying, what's the big deal? What's the difference? He likes her anyways, you know. Well, what difference would it make? The answer is, it makes a big difference. You have to let he likes her right now. But if the Megillah teaches you one thing, it teaches you about the mode of operation of the instinctual being, Achashverosh and Haman are the instinctual beings, as opposed to the, you know, people who live on a higher principle, as opposed to people like Mordechai. Mordechai lives in accordance with ideas. He lives in a rational type of existence. But those who live instinctually, and you see how the tzaddik has to interact with them, he takes into consideration their nature. And instinctual people, you know, you see with Achashverosh. One day he's making a party, he's happy, he's married to Vashti. And apparently he loved Vashti very much. We see clearly he did. And he loves her, so he wants to show her off in front of everybody. And he summons her to appear. And she refuses to appear. But still, he had a tremendous amount of love for her, and in spite of that, he executes her. We know that, because afterwards, when his anger subsides, he's in great, he misses her. He missed her, so he regretted what happened. All right, so then they come up to try and find a substitute. But you see how fickle these type of people can be, how things can change from one day to the next. So therefore, he understood that it was very important not to reveal the identity. It just so happens, coincidentally, the failure to reveal the identity becomes extremely important later on. But that's not why he did it. Because since had he known that she was Jewish all along, it would have had a different impact. Then when she, on that night, the second night, when she reveals that she's Jewish, and that in accordance with the plan of Haman, she too would have been killed, that she's actually pleading for her life, it has a tremendous impact upon Achashverosh, and turns him even more against Haman, you see? So that itself now becomes a surprise revelation. This becomes the moment to reveal. Then she revealed it, interestingly enough. Now she violates the command, of Mordechai, because until now she even followed his command not to reveal it. Then she reveals it, and it becomes extremely important. That's not the reason, we can't say that that's the reason why Mordechai commanded it all along, because he knew that he did it at the time, because he was acting in accordance with principles. That it made no sense, it was bad to give away that information, because it would strengthen the bond. And this way he might tire of her and get rid of her and look for a different queen, and why create a greater attachment? That was his philosophy. But it just so happened that for a totally different reason, coincidentally, so to speak, or maybe not coincidentally, but for a totally different reason, see, when you're acting intelligently and correctly, it works on different levels. It was the correct thing to do in and of itself. And in addition, it just so happened that it gave her an extra weapon in her armory at the time that she needed it. Because when she finally did reveal it, she had something to reveal. It had an impact upon Achashverosh.
So Tosis Maskev L'Rav Chisda L'Achash Amilei Kreso. Okay. The Nami Nira the Savar Kereish Lakish. This is a crucial point. Rav Chisda, it appears, holds like Reish Lakish. The boy Kavana. Requires Kavana. All right. Pekain, nevertheless, Savar the Ein Nachon Lavarech B'Tivul Sheni. Still he holds, because if that's the case, then everything should be fine. You make the Bar Pri Adama on the first Tivul, and you don't have a Mar on L'Shem Mitzvah, so you're not Yotzei the Mitzvah. And then the second Tivul, you have in mind L'Shem Mitzvah. But he says, no, Apo Pekain, nevertheless, Savar, but it's not proper to make the bracha b'tibul sheni. Kivin shekvar milei kreso, since he's already filled his belly.
Just the various components of the plan. We explained there were two elements to the plan, or two questions that we had. One question was, why didn't she do what Mordechai had said? Why didn't she make a direct appeal to throw herself at the king's mercy? I think we explained that already, right? The basic explanation for that was because she recognized the nature of the relationship that existed between Achashverosh and Haman, and that the plan that Achashverosh had endorsed was based upon a certain assumption that he had about Haman. And that assumption was that Haman was completely loyal to him. Even though he recognized that Haman was a person who craved the power and was an egotist, but nevertheless there was an alliance. An alliance had been created between them, and in which Haman would have the power and he would take care of the affairs of government, and Achashverosh would therefore be free to enjoy the pleasures, because the prime mover in his personality was the pursuit of the pleasure. So this was the nature of the alliance, but therefore, as long as that was in effect, as long as that was the basic attitude of Achashverosh, it would be impossible to make a plea along these lines, because his basic inclination would be that this is a policy which has been established by Haman, and it's the correct thing to do. He wouldn't be open to listening to a plea for mercy. It would fall on deaf ears. That's why she didn't take that route. Now the question is, what was the positive? What was she trying to do? What was the idea of the party and then the delay, and asking them to come back the second day? I think the let's take a look at the strategy that she employs at the second party. Yeah, take a look at Perek Zayin. Vayavo Hamelech v'Haman lishtos im Esther Hamalka. And the king and Haman came to drink with Esther Hamalka, the queen. And of course the king said to her on the second day at the party, what is your request and what is your petition? Up to half the kingdom and it will be done. And Esther answered, and she said, "If I have found favor in your eyes, the king,
And if it is good with the king, then give me my life at my request and my nation at my petition. Now I think the next pasuk contains the entire essence of her plea. Ki nimkarnu aniva mi, for I have been sold, me and my nation, to be destroyed, to be killed, to be completely annihilated. Now here's a very important point. However, had we been sold into slavery for slaves, then I would be quiet, because then it wouldn't be worth the damage. Then I'd be quiet and I would accept it because of the damage that would cause to the king, because of the loss. I wouldn't protest it. That's the essence of our plea. Then the response of Achashverosh is very difficult, because he acts like he doesn't know what's going on. Then Achashverosh said to the Queen Esther, Who is this person? Me who ze vi e ze who? Who is this person and who is he? Whose heart conceived of such an idea, that his heart moved him to do such a thing. And then, of course, Vatomer Esther, and Esther says, this man, the antagonist, enemy, Haman, the evil Haman. And Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. And then the king gets up from his anger, from the party, and he goes into the garden. And then this last thing is extremely strange. This last scenario is extremely strange. And Haman gets up. This is something like in some kind of a drama. Very strange. But it's very strange because it doesn't seem to make psychological sense. Haman gets up to plead with Esther because he saw that the king had turned against him, that he was in bad shape at this point in time. So he tried to extricate himself. Now what happens next is a crazy kind of scene. Then the king returns from the garden to the place where they're having the party, and Haman had fallen on the couch that Esther was on. Of course he had done so to plead for mercy. And the king said, are you also so arrogant to conquer the queen with me in the house? And then that was it. And Haman heard that. But the question is, this has to make sense. I mean, is that true? Did Ahasuerus really believe? It may have that appearance, but of course he wasn't stupid. Anybody would realize, whatever you want to say about him, it seems as though he's accusing Haman of making some kind of an advance, a sexual advance against the queen in his presence. Like that's was that something totally irrational? It came out of nowhere. It doesn't make sense. We have to try and explain all these things. Okay. What was the key element, though, in her plea? The pasuk of Ki Nimkarnu was really a refutation. As a refutation of an argument that was made by Haman. What argument is that? That goes back to a different pasuk. The entire plan, when it was presented, it was conceived by Haman. Of course it was based upon his underlying emotion of hatred, but he couldn't show that. He had to cover his emotion and to present it as something which was objective. Now, where does he present that? Perigimel. Yeah, Vayomer Perigimel Pasuk Ches. Vayomer Haman Lamelach HaKashverosh Yeshno Amechad. See, that is the argument. There are two arguments over here. The argument of Haman is Yeshno Amechad, Mefuzar Mefored Bein Ha'amim, V'chol Medinos Malchusecha. There is a nation which is spread out and separate amongst the nations and all of the lands of your kingdom, your empire. And their laws are different, and the laws of the king they don't keep. Rashi says the implication is that they don't pay their taxes. V'la melech ein shov al hanicham. It's not worth your while. It's impractical to maintain them. So the argument that he made, of course he couldn't say that there was anything personal involved. He couldn't do that. But the argument was that this is not beneficial to you, that this people is a disloyal people,
and it's not in your best interest to maintain them in your kingdom. That was the argument to which Ahasuerus had agreed. Ahasuerus agreed. He bought. He accepted that. The entire plea, the entire plan of Esther was to refute that. It's quite the contrary. And see, her argument was that just the opposite. That we are the loyal ones. The Jews are loyal, and Haman is disloyal. And the reason is very simple. Because if the plan was based purely for the benefit of the king, to enrich the king, so then why did he have to decree annihilation? There's no benefit. All he had to do was to decree that we should be slaves. If we were, this is a tremendous source of economic benefit. You see, he didn't think it through. There's a tremendous source of economic benefit to the king. All of the Jews are productive people; they could work and so on and so forth. If his interest was purely for the sake of the king, so then he should have worked out a plan whereby we have to work for the king. It's a tax, some kind of a tax. Then we would have been glad, and I would not even have complained. Basically, what she was arguing is the whole brilliance of the plan was to show that you made a serious mistake. You made a very serious mistake in your evaluation of Haman. But you see, she couldn't say that directly in a manner which would be insulting to him. She planted the seeds. I believe that the plan of the previous, everything she did from the moment that she agreed to appear before Ahasuerus was designed to establish the proper atmosphere in which this argument would be received. And she needed two things for that. First of all, she needed time. It takes time to quote. When a person has, you know, any kind of a relationship, any type of, you know, where he's invested in something, it takes time to undo. She needed time. And it's not just, also the overnight is extremely important. So she used the first day, she understood the significance of planting seeds. She wanted to arouse, she was able to arouse strong emotions. And she knew that a lot of the things, the way the psyche works is that, I think I mentioned this already, that a lot of things happen in the course of the day and their significance is not immediately, the impact is not made immediately, but they come up at night. In other words, during the course of the day, a lot, you know, you're meeting people, this, that, somebody, you saw somebody on the train, someone said a word. At the time, you just brushed it aside. But then, in the middle of the night, that could trigger something. And well, later on at night, that could arouse certain trains of thought within you. So that the idea, for example, when she first mentioned that she wants to make this special party for the king, and she's just inviting the king and Haman, so he didn't make a big deal about it. He didn't ask. He didn't even stop and say, well, why? What does Haman have to do with this? But later on, this bothered him very much. You see? That's why he couldn't. So she aroused strong feelings within the king. Tremendous feeling of suspense, of curiosity, of love. Love for Esther. But there was something that was troubling in the entire thing. And what was troubling in the entire thing was that what does Haman have to do with this? This was not his area. This was supposed to be something which was personal between the queen and the king and Ahasuerus. What is Haman doing over here? See, what is Haman doing over here? He couldn't sleep, and of course that's the night of the Ashkacha. The Ashkacha worked side by side. The Ashkacha worked in line to bring her plan to fruition, because they bring him the history books, and that's why he starts searching. It wasn't by accident that he found the incident of Big Son and Sarish. As we pointed out, he was looking. He was looking unconsciously for information. It wasn't by accident, I say, that he was searching for information. He was looking at the situation in an entirely different light. And then one thing led to another. When he discovered that Big Son and Sarish, Mordechai hadn't been rewarded. That was a serious mistake, as we said, politically by Haman, because it showed it was a lapse.